Yes. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Torah Studies. This is where we, of course, study Torah. Who saw that coming? All right. So it's okay. Wherever you're comfortable. So the Torah portion this week is Pinchas. And you can find it in the Chumash on page 1040 and 1041. Reminds you of tax season, doesn't it? Joking. Isn't there a 1040? There's a 1044. Okay. Anyway, 1040, 1041, Pinchas, Torah portion. Oh, so the topic tonight is Rosh Chodesh, which is Rosh. What does Rosh Chodesh mean? Rosh means head, and Chodesh means month. So it's the head of the month, i.e. the first day of the Jewish month. Just like we have Rosh Hashanah, which is the beginning of the year, we have Rosh Chodesh 12 times a year, which is the beginning of the month, and that is the topic of tonight. Now, I should mention that today is the 18th day of the month of Tammuz. So we're nowhere near Rosh Chodesh. We're like almost right in the middle of this month. Nonetheless, tonight we talk about Rosh Chodesh because in this week's Torah portion, there is a discussion about what should be done in the temple on the day of Rosh Chodesh. But first, let me take you through a quick tour of the Torah portion. Okay, so 1040, 1041 portion opens up with Pinchas, who is the hero. At the end of last week's Torah portion, he is the guy that stabs the Jewish prince and the Midianite princess who were together in the tent. So he kills them, and the plague ends. And God says, "Therefore, I will give Pinchas the gift of the kahuna, the gift of the priesthood." Okay. After that, we have the census, and the way it's captioned on page 1043. Is Moshe's final census. This is the last time Moshe counted the people. Moshe counted the people at the behest of God several times. This is at the end of the 40 years. Moshe was about to pass away. So this is the last census, and the results are in. The total number, this goes on for a number of pages, the total number is 601,730, which is pretty much the same number of men, 20 to 60, that there were 40 years earlier, right after the Exodus. I think then it was like 600,500, somewhere around there. So you gained a few hundred people. You lost people, you gained people, but that's pretty much the same number. Okay, after that, the Torah talks about the division of the land. Just going through the captions here. 1051, division of the land. God says how the land should be divided. It was meant to be done by a lottery, and also taken into consideration the size of the families within the tribes. So that was a very interesting system, the way that worked. We're not going to focus on it now. Then the Levites were counted, 1053. 1055, Tzelafchad's daughters say, "Hey, we want to go into the land of Israel also. And our father died, but we're daughters. And therefore, by the rules of inheritance thus far, daughters don't inherit a father. So we need to change that because we want a portion of the land." And Moshe says, "That's a good point." Speaks with God, and God says, "That's exactly the way it should be. If a father passes away without sons, it goes to the daughters." Understand the reason, the rationale behind the law in its original form. It's because the understanding is that the daughters, please God, will get married, and when they marry, they will share within their husband's territory. So the thought was maybe they don't need their father's territory because then they're going to have two territories and it's going to be a little bit mixed up. Unless God says that's the way indeed it should go, that they should get, as long as they're, you know, not married, whatever, they should get that inheritance. And they would keep it after they got married. Then the Torah talks about in general laws of inheritance. And then 1059, a very pivotal moment that we're not going to focus on. Joshua, Yeshua is appointed Moshe's successor. And then we get to 1061. You see, we're preparing, the Torah is preparing us for Moshe's passing. 1061, the Torah portion kind of drifts away and talks about something else. Communal offerings. This sounds like it should be in Leviticus, because Leviticus is where you have a lot of the offerings, but it's right here. Communal offerings, these are the offerings that were brought in the temple, or in the tabernacle, and later on in the temple. One is the temporary structure, one is the permanent structure. They were brought on behalf of the community, hence the title, communal offerings. We know that an individual might be obligated to bring an offering. So if you had a child, you're the mom, you bring an offering. If you became impure and you were purified, you would bring an offering. If you decided to be generous and donate something, then you would bring an offering. If you sinned and you wanted to atone for it, you brought an offering. Different opportunities for individuals to bring an offering, but there was also a communal offering brought every single day, twice a day, once in the morning, once in the afternoon, on behalf of the entire congregation of Israel. That is known as the Tamid. Tamid. Tamid means constant. It's called constant because it's the unwavering offering that was brought every single day without fail, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, two lambs. That was on behalf of the entire community, and it was considered to be an offering on their behalf. And everyone contributed. That was the half shekel donation, which we've talked about in other classes. Okay, then the Torah continues to talk about special offerings that were also brought. Special offerings that were brought on special days, but also on behalf of the entire congregation, i.e., not an individual's offering. So, 1063. This is what we want to get to. The last section. We have continual offerings, additional offerings of Shabbat, known as the Musaf. Today we have prayers that commemorate the additional sacrifices. And now we get on the bottom of 1063 to the communal Rosh Chodesh offering. And this is how we bring it all together for today's class. So Alex, please read this one. Verse number 11, 1063. And if you don't mind, you'll read basically on the till the next page, till Passover.
At the beginning of every month, you shall offer a burnt offering to God, two young bulls, one ram, and seven lambs in their first year, all perfect and unblemished.
I should mention, that's a lot of animals right there. That's 10 animals. Every Rosh Chodesh. Continue.
3/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with oil as a meal offering for each bull. 2/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with oil as a meal offering for each ram, and 1/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with oil as a meal offering for each lamb. It is a burnt offering with a pleasant aroma for God, a fire offering for God. The accompanying libations are a half of a hin of wine for each bull, a third of a hin for each ram, and a quarter of a hin for each lamb. This burnt offering of each new month must be offered on its appropriate month throughout the months of the year. There is no possibility of compensation.
In other words, if you miss one month, you can't double up, double or nothing the next month. That's not how it works. You got to bring it on that Rosh Chodesh for that month. Continue, please.
One young male goat should be offered up as a sin offering to God to atone for your inadvertent ritual contaminations of the temple. All of the above is to be offered in addition to the daily burnt offering and its libations.
All right, so that's it. So you have animals, you have flour offerings, and then you have the liquid. Hey, you got to wash it down with something. So you have the wine libations, and that is what is brought every Rosh Chodesh. And the last line is nice because it pulls everything together. All of this is in addition to the daily tamid. I mentioned before, every single day there were two offerings brought in the morning, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. In addition to that, this was an extra special one for Rosh Chodesh, and that's what it was, what we just read, that's what was brought. As long as the Mishkan Tabernacle, portable sanctuary, stood, as long as the Beit HaMikdash, the Holy Temple, the permanent sanctuary in Jerusalem stood, they brought these offerings on Rosh Chodesh. So this went on for how long? So the temple stood for about 830 years. The first one was 410, the second one was 420, together that's 830. The tabernacle was another 400-500 years. So you're talking about 1300, 1400 years of Jewish history. This is how Rosh Chodesh was celebrated. Today, there's no temple. And since there's, if you could pass this down, please. Pass it on to Peter. And there's no temple today, so obviously we're not running on Rosh Chodesh to get some bulls, right?
What time of the day was that?
This was in the afternoon. It was in the afternoon.
And who brought it?
The Kohen. Only a Kohen was allowed to offer the sacrifices. Now, you could, I should clarify, as a non-Kohen, you could commission an offering, but the Kohen had to do the service. The slaughtering and whatever, like the different pieces of the service. I think maybe slaughtering could have been done by someone who's not a Kohen. But a lot of the stuff, a lot of the processes, I guess, had to be done by a Kohen.
So you just brought, like,
so you schlepped your animal. Listen, I mean, think about it. You're schlepping animals. There was a whole, like, I mean, there's a whole cottage industry behind this temple business, right? It's like Animals R Us. If you needed an animal, right, where are you going to get an animal from? I'm sure there were shops and whatever that would sell you an animal. Hey, you need a bull? Right?
I got a bull.
Have I got a bull for you? right? No bull. No, so this is...
Yeah.
But why so many animals?
These are good questions.
Maybe,
I'm sure there's symbolism, but this is, I don't know, this is it. What do you do with the flower?
You have what, a plate with a piece of flour? I mean, what do you do with this?
3/10 of a fine flour mixed with oil as a meal offering. I think they cooked the meal offering, I want to say.
They
cooked
oil?
It. Remember we talked about this?
Yeah.
There was the fried, the deep fried, the shallow fried pan. Yeah. The southern style meal offering. We spoke about this a few in Leviticus. So yeah, they used to do something with it. And most of this, except for burnt offerings, which I think were totally burnt, a lot of it was eaten by the Kohen. Kohen's got to eat.
So if the flour just had oil, then it was like matzah?
Some of it was like matzah, yeah.
It was flour?
I guess. I mean, matzah doesn't have oil, but
just
water. Flour and oil? I don't know. That's the real deal. That's like deep fried flour, basically. I like my flour and oil with more oil. Kidding. Anyway, so that's it. What, you know? Listen, we'll have a third temple soon. Today, by tomorrow morning, we'll be back in action. We'll do a taste test.
So, if it was,
would you like a piece of the bull, a piece of the ram, or a piece of the lamb? You're in the mood for lamb?
Yeah.
What's ram meat? Does anyone have ram meat?
A ram chop?
Is it a goat? Has anyone eaten goat?
Yeah.
Goat's kosher.
Yeah.
How come no one eats goat? I've never seen goat on... What is shawarma? Is it... Goat?
What?
Is it really? Oh, come on. I think I just said it. The shawarma. What is shawarma? Is that...
Yeah,
it's lamb. It's lamb. Okay. Got it. Ram, I like that. Look at that. I'm right with you. Anyway, look, this is it. Okay, so let's get back. So our topic then, based on this little sentence, this little paragraph, is Rosh Chodesh. So let's take a step back before we talk about how we celebrate it today, and the special connection that Rosh Chodesh has with women. And I brought a special text called Feminine Faith, which we once did. Were you there for that? You did that. We did this once at Kabbalah and Coffee a few years ago. Great, great discourse. So before we get there, let's talk about the Jewish calendar as a bit of a refresher reminder for some, and maybe for some it's hearing this some of these details for the first time. So the Jewish calendar is, I'll ask a question, pop quiz. Jewish calendar, is it lunar-based or solar-based?
Hybrid.
You guys are on to me. It's both. It's both. The months are lunar. The years are lunar solar. Let's explain. How do you measure time? First of all, why do you need to measure time? Think about it. Why do you need a calendar in the first place?
Because you have an appointment.
One reason is, if you want to set a time in the future, you need a point of reference how far in the future. What are you going to say? You know what my kids say? My kids go by sleeps. You know, did anyone else's kids do this? They go by like how many nights need to pass before this is happening. Like, oh, when are we going to the baseball game? Not this year. Forget about that. Joking. Anyway, whatever. They do that in the sleeps?
Yeah.
Nights?
200 days and a wake up.
Interesting. Okay. All right. I don't know. Maybe we militarize our kids. Kidding. We don't. So they're like, oh, how many days till the thing? Or how many sleeps? How many nights until this thing? So it's like, what, 4 days, 5 days, whatever. So that's one way to measure. So one need for time, for a calendar, for time measurement, is because you want to know when you're setting something in the future. You're supposed to meet someone. Something's supposed to happen. Well, when exactly is it going to happen? Or how do you mark the past? The present, I don't think we need a calendar for the present. Unless you need to know vis-a-vis something that happened in the past that you're commemorating or whatever. Otherwise, what day is it today? Who cares? Just live the day. Right? You disagree. You're shaking your head at me. You're saying, I'm not going to get away with this this theory.
I need to know our Wednesday Torah class.
Okay, but that's because you have something on your calendar, because you put it. Okay, now I hear you. Fine. Good. Right. So you need to know the day. Good. So we get that we need to know based on the past, like how to mark something in the past, how to mark something in the future, and how to know what's happening today. Is it, you know what's interesting? So Hadassah. You know Hadassah?
No, not that either.
You know who Hadassah was?
No.
We know Esther. We know Esther, Queen Esther. Her real name, her Jewish name was Hadassah. That was her Jewish name. Her given name was Hadassah. And Hadassah was taken by the king's soldiers, right? We all know the story. He was looking for a queen, and so she got taken. She was not interested, but it didn't matter. And she got set in. Now, the Persians then, because they were under the Persian Empire, the Persians had a 10-day week. Yes. Yes, they had a 10-day week. It's a nice round number. Why seven? You ever wonder why seven? We've talked about this before. Why seven? Because God created the world in 7 days. And we're sticking to that. Now, but they had 10, the Persians. And she was facing a challenge. Why? Because she wanted to keep Shabbat. How do you keep Shabbat without a calendar, without a Jewish calendar? She can't put up like the Jewish calendar from the funeral home in the palace, because that would be a dead, no pun intended, giveaway. Right? That's going to give it away right away that she, oh, I'm not telling you my nationality. She puts up the dresser's calendar. It's like, what? That's a, hello, right? You with me on this?
Couldn't she just put marks on the wall?
She could, but she did something else. She had seven maids or seven assistants, whatever. I'm sure they were maids. Right, so she had seven handmaids. Maybe it sounds better. And she gave one per day, so that, and they cycled through, so every time it was that particular maid, so she knew that it was Shabbat.
What do you mean she gave one?
She said, handmaid A, your day one, two, three, four, five. That way she marked the day, so she knew when every seventh day came up. So she knew whatever day she got in the palace, she knew what day that was, and she was able to keep count of the rest of the days with these maids. You with me on this?
It seemed like every day would be a Sabbath day if you were a queen.
If you were the queen. Yeah, I don't know. If I'm ever there, I'll let you know. Now, one second. The other cool thing about that was that she didn't have to hide what she was doing because the maids didn't know what she did on any other day. So the Shabbat maid didn't know that she was abstaining from her usual work because she didn't see her the other days. That makes sense, right? Because that was just the way she was on that day. Fine. Why am I mentioning this? Because it's really handy to have a calendar. Today we have calendars on our phone, we have calendars on our wall, we have calendars on our computers, we have calendars in our head, whatever it is, we have calendars. So that's why we need a calendar. The question is, how do you measure time? So there's really three major ways to measure time. You can measure days. Days are marked by sun up, sun down, the cycle of the sun. You can measure, again, weeks aren't really a measurement. It's just seven of those, but why? It could be eight of those, nine of those. So a week doesn't have a natural thing. Month, though, has a natural thing. A month has the moon. The lunar cycle is 29 and a half days. So that gives you also somewhat of a bigger frame of reference. So if we have a loan, you know, you borrow money from me, and I say, okay, so I'll give you a little, I'm going to give you more than a day to pay back, but I don't want to give you a year. I want to give you like a month. So what do? When the moon looks the same next time around, right? That's how they used to do it back in the day. They didn't have dates. Maybe they did have dates. I'm not going to record on that. But this would be a measure to say when the moon gets back to that size, right? Okay, so then the loan is up. So that's another natural way of measuring time. The third way, of course, is a year. And a year is also measured by the sun again. And that has to do with where the sun is and its annual cycling of the sun and the earth, which takes, of course, as we know, 365 and, what is it, 365 and a quarter? I want to say? It's been a while?
Yes.
365 and a quarter. So, different calendars, different ways of measuring time. So how do you set a calendar? So in ancient times, the first calendars were set according to the lunar cycle, which means they just measured it by the moon, 29 and a half days, that created a new month, and that was it. The problem is, you don't really get an annual cycle out of that. You don't get, like, if you get 12 of those, you're not really accurately getting back to the season that you started in. because as we discussed many times in this class, the solar cycle is 365 and a quarter days, as mentioned. The lunar cycle is 29 and a half days times 12, only nets you 354 days. So if you have 12 months of the lunar cycle, so you max out your 12 for a year, it's only 354 days. You're still 11 days short. So if you begin at a certain day and you stretch out a solar year and a lunar year, your lunar year is going to be here, which is 11 days earlier. So if I tell you, come back to my farm in a year and I'll give you some of my crops, but I don't want to share right now. So come back next year and you'll get some of my grapes. If I tell you that, when are you coming back?
Lunar.
If you come back the lunar, the grapes are not up yet. You got that? Because it's messing up with the seasons. The seasons go by the solar calendar. If you go by the lunar calendar, then your agriculture is off. You with me?
The
seasons are by the lunar, right? The solar.
Yes.
The 365 and a quarter. You with me on this?
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, the solar year, what we have, the Gregorian calendar, the American calendar, right? It's 365 and a quarter days. So we know that every spring is in the spring and summer is in the summer. All the seasons are set quarterly. So if you go by the lunar months, you're not gonna end up with it doesn't work with the seasons. It just works with the moon, but that's not tied in with the seasons. So it's very inefficient for an agricultural society. So then they switched over to the solar calendar. Fine, so they use a solar calendar. Solar calendar was fine. But then you don't have months, right? Because a solar calendar is just a full year.
Well, that's why you need a complicated watch, because it's got the moon phase.
Right. And they can just raise the price by a few thousand, right.
And then it's got, you know,
the solar phase. Exactly. You got the days and you have the lunar phase, and it's a complicated algorithm. So the Egyptians, for example, the ancient Egyptians, they had a solar calendar. So what they do, the solar year is 365. By the way, the ancient civilizations, the ancient chachamim, wise people, they knew astronomy. They knew these calculations. They were just like, ooh, wheel, me like wheel, fire. I mean, they were intelligent. They knew astronomy. They knew calculations. They were very well versed. So they knew that a year was 365 and a quarter days. They got that. So the Egyptians, for example, what they did was they divided it into 12 months of 30 days each, which is how many days? 12 times 30?
360.
And then they had 5 days without a month. That was their year. Notice they went by the solar calendar, the solar cycle. So a year is whatever it was, let's say for us, January 1st to January 1st, or January 1st to December 31st, 365 days. So how'd they do it? Each month was 30 days. They had 12 30-day months. And at the end, they didn't call it December, but because, you know, that's later on. This is ancient Egypt. They had 5 days of just, you know, filler, and then we start again. That's how they did it. Fine.
You're saying there's no month, it was just 5 days?
Just five stragglers.
At
5 days without a home. At the end of the 12, after 12 rounds of 30, they had another five. Whatever, five left over. It's like when you do an addition, you like throw a number on top of another one. It's like, oh. 30 correspond to a month? Yeah. There were 12 months of 30.
But did the 30 correspond to the
Oh, so that's an approximate, right? Because the lunar cycle is 29 and a half days. You round up to 30, but it's not exact. 29 and a half, if you just do 30, 30, 30, 30, after a few months, you're just off. Because you're just ahead, you're right? Because if you keep on rounding up, you're after 5 years, you're way off the original cycles. So that's not looking at the lunar calendar. Then you have the Muslim calendar, which is, as we've discussed in other classes before, the Muslim calendar goes by the moon, not by the sun. So again, if you're a farmer, that doesn't help you. Number one, number two, the holidays in that system don't fall out in the same season of the year. Because if you have a holiday in the fourth month of the lunar month, so the next time the fourth month comes around, it's 11 days earlier of the solar in the seasons, which is why Ramadan falls out different times of the year, different seasons. So one time it might be in the spring, one time it might be in the winter, one time it might be in the fall.
So if Gregorian
yes.
calendar.
Yes.
Is that the calendar you described? Is that the Julian calendar?
No, I don't believe so. The Julian calendar. No, I was describing before with the extra 5 days. That was the ancient Egyptian calendar.
Okay, but no, the Muslim calendar.
No. That's not Julian. No. Julian calendar is similar to the Gregorian calendar. There's a few differences that I'm not familiar with. I mean, I've read it before. I don't remember. Yeah.
The only problem is they're seven figures.
And the other problem is there's going to be a massive problem that no one's even anticipating. Why 3K? It's going to be crazy. Joking. That was a joke. Remember Y2K? It was like going to destroy the world? Okay. All right. We're too serious.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do what I can.
Are you saying the Muslim calendar is strictly lunar?
That's what I'm saying. They go, their holidays, yeah, strictly lunar, and they just cycle through. So here's the deal. Since the solar calendar, the 365, and the lunar cycle, 29 and a half days, they don't really work together naturally. So people have chosen historically to go either one or the other. The Jews have chosen both. Why? Because we like to get everything we can. We'll take one of those and one of those. Don't give me a dessert option on the menu because I'm going to have the sampler. I mean, that's just the way it is. Give me a buffet. You're going to have a little bit of each. So what we have is a system where we take the months. The months go by the lunar cycle, so it's a real month. It's not. See, in America, we have 30 and 31 days. Why? What happens every 30 and 31 days? It's a month. Why? What happens in the universe every 30, 31 days? Nothing. You turn the page in your calendar. You rip off another thing, a Far Side comic. Whatever calendar you have, right? Another inspirational quote for the month. Why? Random. 30 and 31 days. 30 days has blah, blah, blah. I don't even know the song. I remember that. Remember the knuckle thing? Remember the knuckle?
How do they decide which is 30
and 30? So random. But what I'm saying is more than which month gets which, the whole notion of 30 and 31 is totally, what's the word I'm looking for? Arbitrary. Totally arbitrary. Does not correspond to any natural reality that's happening. So Judaism says, no, a month is going to be a real reality. It's going to reflect the cycle of the moon. So therefore, Jewish month is either 29 days or 30 days. Because, again, the lunar cycle is 29 and a half days. So some months is 29 days, some months is 30 days. And that way, you're following the lunar cycle. So every Rosh Chodesh, which is the topic of tonight, every Rosh Chodesh, which means the first of the month in the Jewish calendar, you can look up in the sky and see the same thing. Assuming it's not cloudy, every single Jewish month, you'll see a sliver of a moon. The day before you didn't see it, now you see it, welcome to the new Jewish month. It follows a astronomical reality in the universe. You with me?
Don't three men have to agree, three people have to call and say it's all the same?
No, you're talking about the story with the three wise men at the crossroads with the moon? No, I made that up. No. We'll talk about that in a second. I was just joking about the three wise men at the crossroads. No, we'll talk about that in a second. Yes, originally this was done by. That's hilarious. That would be really funny. It's like, oh, I'm sorry, we're disturbing Ponce. There's really loud street. Shh, we're trying to drive here. Okay, so it's like too much noise. Crank up the radio. Thanks for checking.
What's up? I'm sorry. My camera
on for
what? I got an email about
Elijah.
Oh, you know.
Oh, it's Robert Rabbit's house. 990 St. Charles.
990.
Right around the corner.
Yeah, it's
you're 2 minutes away.
St. Charles is.
Right behind the next block over. You're like very close. Let me exaggerate how close you are. You're a second away. Okay, so get back to this. Yeah, I'm gonna get there in a second. Let me just wrap this up. So the Jewish month reflects a real reality. It's a reality. By the way, every 15th day of the month, right in the center, 15th day of the Jewish month, look up in the sky, guess what you see?
Full moon.
Full moon. Ow. Right? 15, 14, 15, right in the middle of the month, 15. Day 15 at night, it's 18 now. So we know it's going to be a little bit waning. It's going to be a little bit, I don't know the angle, which way it's going, but it's going to be not 100%, it's getting a little bit smaller right now. But the 15th of each month, Jewish month? The 15th day of the English month of our Gregorian calendar? The 15th of July? What's the moon going to look like? Who knows? Who knows? Every Jewish month, the 15th of every Jewish month, full moon. Every Passover, Passover is the 15th, full moon. Sukkot, 15th of the month, guess what? Full moon. So it's a reality, the month's a reality. At the same time, we know that the Jewish calendar also follows the solar cycle because we have to keep the holidays in the right seasons. Sukkot has to happen in the fall, and more importantly, and very essentially, Passover must occur in the spring like it did the first time around. God says, observe the Passover, commemorate the Exodus at the season that it happened, Bechodesh Ha'aviv, in the spring season. If it's not in the spring, then you ain't doing it right. So if you have 12 months, if you were celebrating Passover 12 lunar months later, understand this very simple idea. You would be 11 days earlier in the seasons than you were the first time around. And after 2 years, you would be 22 days earlier. And after 3 years, you'd be 33 days earlier. Which means after 6 years, you're 2 months earlier. So if the first Passover occurred April 1st, no kidding, April Fool's Day. Right, if the first, Pharaoh's like, ah, got you, come on back. And they're like, no, we're gone. He's like, what, I have to chase you to the sea and drown? Yes, you do. Okay, so every year, imagine 6 years after the Exodus, it's no longer April 1st. It's not March 1st, it's February 1st. And guess what? We're showing up to the Seder in our parkas. And our fur coats. Oh, it's a nice fur. Yeah, I got it for Passover. Right? That's the way it would be. So, and that can't happen. So therefore, we have a system where we throw in a leap year. Every few years, we throw in a leap year. It's a leap year, which means that we throw in an extra month, an extra Adar. Right before Passover, we throw in an extra month. And that pushes Passover forward into the spring. So where does this leave us? Is it? Hopefully it's somewhat clear. Let's jump into some texts. Because why not? Because we haven't read text yet, so we should do that.
Is there a sort of body
that sets the Jewish calendar?
Yeah,
I'll talk about that in a second. Take a look. Take a look-see.
How often is the leap year thrown in?
Every 3 years or so. There's a 19-year cycle. 7 of 19 years is a leap year. Yeah, it's a complicated algorithm. If it was exactly every 3 years, it would be 7 every 21 years, but it's not. It's 7 every 19 years. There's a 19-year cycle. 7 of 19 are leap years with an extra month.
Two Adar.
Yeah, because Passover is Nisan. No, well, there's what we call Purim Katan, which is the first Adar, and you celebrate in the second Adar. The first Adar, you kind of like, woohoo, you say a little L'chaim. And then the second one is when you go to town. Yeah, Katan. And you do the second one because you want to have Gu'ula to Gu'ula. You want to have the two redemptions close to each other. You want to have the salvation of Purim close to the salvation of Passover. You don't want to do it in the first one, you do it in the second one. Does that make sense? So you celebrate the holiday of Purim in Adar Sheni, in the second Adar, so that it's close to Passover as opposed to doing it in the first one, and then you have 2 months in between.
So how many days are in a leap year?
Oh, so a leap year, 13 months. A full month extra. Unlike the American leap year, which is just one day in February. Now, let's take a look at... No, we're not going to do these texts. We've done them in other classes. I don't want to do them. So let's move on. Let's further the narrative. Back in the day, for 1,600 plus years of Jewish history, from the times of Moses through the times of the Second Temple and into a little bit past the Temple's destruction, for all those years, Rosh Chodesh was determined by human witnesses. Eyewitness news. So what would happen was like this. On day number 30, the court would be in session. The Sanhedrin, the the high court in Jerusalem would be in session. And they would receive people, witnesses, that claimed to have seen the moon the night before, i.e., the night after the 29th day. You with me? So today is day 30 of the Jewish month. Yesterday was day 29. So last night was, I don't know, between 29 and 30. So the new moon could either be that night, the night between 29 and 30, or between 30 and 31. Those are your only two options. You with me? Again, the month is 29 and a half days. So you have to fall one side or the other. So some months will be 29 days, some months will be 30 days. So the court will be open on day number 30. People would come to the court and testify if they saw the moon the night before. And the judges would grill them. Where were you? You saw the moon last night? Where exactly were you standing? What mountaintop? What street? What do you remember about the night of the 29th? Right. So where were you standing? Where were you facing? What did the sky look like? Where was the moon? Show me. Where was the moon? What angle was it facing? How big did it look? They asked them all these questions. You needed two witnesses. You needed two kosher witnesses to both testify that they saw it in the same place. They didn't have to do it together. They did it separately. But if you had two witnesses, then the bet then and the court would say, the Sanhedrin would say, they would say, Mekudash, which means it has been sanctified. Only if you had the two witnesses would they say, Mekudash, it's been sanctified. They would split them up, as we'll see in this text 4C, that's what we're going to be getting with this one, 4C on page 264. They split them up and they grilled them to make sure that they were not making up a false claim. Oh, one more thing. The judges knew if they were lying. How did they know? Because again, they were astronomers. They were very well versed in the science of astronomy, and they knew where the moon would have been last night. So you came to testify about it. I know where it's going to be. And if what you're saying doesn't make sense, I know you're making it up. You may have seen a star. You may have seen an airplane. Back then they had airplanes. So you may, asteroids. Yeah, androids. You may have seen many, iPhone. You may have seen many different things. But it may not be the moon unless you get the details right. So Lolly, if you're up to it, please read text 4C on page, either it's 264, 265. I'm not sure where the English is. 264? I should explain. This is Maimonides discussing the laws of sanctifying the new month.
What is the process through which the testimony regarding the sighting of the moon is accepted? Anyone who saw the moon and is fit to testify should come to the court. The judges should bring them all to a single place and should make a large feast for them so that the people will come regularly.
It's so Jewish. Okay, we're going to have a spread. It's like a Jewish meeting always has food. It's like in the business world. I mean, I don't know. I've only been to Jewish meetings, basically. But like, from what I understand, most meetings don't have food. But if it's a Jewish meeting, it's like, well, there's no food. Why am I here? Why am I wasting my time? Why am I wasting my time? Where are the bagels? All right, sorry, continue.
The pair of witnesses who arrive first are examined first according to the questions mentioned previously. The one of greater stature is invited into a private chamber first and asked these questions. If his testimony is accurate according to the data that the court arrives at through calculations, they invite his colleague in. If their statements are comparable, their testimony is substantiated. Afterwards, that is, after the witness's testimony is substantiated, the head of the court declares, it has been sanctified. And all the people respond, it has been sanctified. It has been sanctified.
So the court says it once and the people respond twice. Mekudash, Mekudash.
Even if the court and the entire Jewish people saw the moon, but the court did not declare that it had been sanctified before the nightfall, beginning the 31st day, or if the witnesses were cross-examined, but afterward the court was not able to declare that it has been sanctified before the nightfall, beginning the 31st day, it should not be sanctified, and the month should be full. despite the fact that the moon was sighted on the 30th night, it is the 31st day that will be Rosh Chodesh. But the sanctification of the new moon is not established by the sighting of the moon, but by the court that declares it has been sanctified.
Does that make sense? That makes sense? Again, a month could either be full or not full. Full means 30 days. Not full is 29 days. Again, the lunar cycle is 29 and a half days. So again, it's Rosh Chodesh. Okay. I wish I had a calendar here. I have a calendar right there. But okay. So a month cannot have less than 29 days. Because a lunar cycle is 29 and a half days. So you're not going to get less than 29 days. So day 29, you're good. The question is day 30. Is that day 30 or day 1? Is it day 30 of the previous month or day 1 of the new month? So day 30, the court is open. Did anyone see that? We have a lot of food here. Did anybody? Are you sure you didn't see it? You want to eat? Yes, you saw it. Okay, so did you see the moon the night before? Witnesses would come. If they testified and it was accepted and the court said Mekudesh and the people said Mekudesh, Mekudesh, it was sanctified, sanctified, sanctified. If that happens, then they spread the message that afternoon. Whoops. Today is Rosh Chodesh. You understand what's going on here? They wouldn't know that it was Rosh Chodesh till midstream of that day. You understand what's going on here? Yes? The court opened up in the morning. The court didn't operate at night. The court, there's no night court here. So the court only opened up in the day. So people from the morning, so if they got it in at some point during the day, that was the earliest time that you would know that today is indeed the first of the month. Otherwise, it's day 30 of the previous month. Hope this is making sense.
Are the men testifying that there's a sliver in the sky?
Yeah, that they saw the emergence of the new moon after it had all but disappeared. It's back and better than ever.
And then it's just a sliver?
It's a sliver. It's really small. So, if that happens, the court will declare. If the court doesn't get to it in time, then it does. Then that's day 30, and the next day by default is Rosh Chodesh. Because they can't go more than 30 days. They're not going to go 31 days.
Not to be stupid, but the day before Rosh Chodesh.
Yes.
You don't see any moon.
No moon, from what I understand. Right? It totally disappears. It's gone. As if there's nothing. No moon. No moon. Okay. Good. So that's that. Oh, text 5. I love the intrigue. Text 5. It reminds me of what's going on here in our country. 266. Peter.
Okay. Originally, testimony with regard to the appearance of the new moon was received from anyone. When, however,
Bothusians
adopted evil courses, it was ordained that testimony should be received only from persons known to.
There were Bothusian influences trying to influence the moon sightings. Yeah. He was a Bothusian. He was a Bothusian. So the Bothusians, they were Baitusim in Talmudic language. The Baitusim were individuals that were not. They would always give the sages and the mainstream Jewish people a hard time. They were the hecklers. They're like, oh, they were Jewish. Yeah, it was a sect. It was one of the sectarians. Some say that the Bothusians were the authors of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Some say that most say no, but some say that they were. Why did they go like that? There was a few things that they took very literally. They didn't believe in an oral tradition, and they said that we can reinterpret things the way we want to see it. And so part of it, they just wanted to throw off the court. So they used to come in and start making up stuff about the moon. Maybe they were privy to the calculations. Maybe they were astronomers, so they were able to like make up a plausible false testimony.
It seems like somebody at this time, with all this effort.
Yeah.
Oh,
so that happened soon. Hold on, we're about to get to this. It's the next text. So hold on. So what happened was, after that point in time, they said only reputable people. It's like, when you go flying and there's like this line of people that don't have to wait in security? You know what I'm talking about? They're like, pre-check, huh? TSA pre-check. These were like moon pre-checks. These are like Sanhedrin pre-checks. These are the guys that are ready to go. They come in, we'll take your testimony. You guys, you're a Bothusian, you're out. I'm sorry, my friend. No Bothusians allowed. Right? No shoes, no shirt, no Bothusians. No, it's not even a thing. All right, done. After 1600 years or so, it was the second or third century when everything changed. The Sanhedrin was about to be disbanded, or was disbanded, and the Jews were being diasporaed, which is now a verb. And what happened was, there was a great sage at the time, Hillel, not the same Hillel that we know and love, but Hillel the prince, not Hillel the great. There's two guys. There's the Hillel that we know, the guy that said, if I'm not for myself, who am I? And if I'm only for myself, what am I? And if not now, when? You know that guy? And the same guy that said, be the disciples of Aaron, love peace, pursue peace, love the creatures and draw them close to the Torah. So that Hillel, that's the older Hillel. He's the Hillel and Shammai Hillel. The younger Hillel, I mean the later Hillel, that's the one we're talking about. He came up with the calculus. He came up with the algorithm. He came up with the calendar that we still use today. It's a perpetual calendar. It does not end. It's so perfect in its calculation, it never falters. You can throw anything you want at it. Throw a once-in-a-lifetime eclipse that happens every 6 months, it seems. Am I wrong? I'm not wrong here. Every few months, you're like, oh my gosh, go outside. It's Mars is huge. It'll never happen. And then 2 months later, it's, oh my God, Mars is huge. This happened like a few,
First time in
80 years, like twice in a week it happened. Doesn't matter. I'm making jokes now. Here's my point. This calculation that Hillel the prince made is rock solid. We use it till today. That's the cycle of the 19 years and 7 leap years and 19 years, blah, blah, blah. So all that stuff, rock solid. And that's the that's the calendar we use to this very day.
So you're saying that was around the 1600s?
No. The 2300s.
Okay.
Really?
Was he in Babylon?
He was in, I don't know. Either in Babylon or in Israel. There were scholars back in Israel then. They were cleared out, but then they came back in. Either one of those areas. But bottom line is, that's when the calendar moved away from the moon sighting court system to the, just pull out your Jewish calendar system and you're good to go. And that's what we've been using for the last 1,600 years. So it's kind of like been evenly balanced. Like 1,650 years, we went with the court, with the moon sighting system. And the next 1,650 years of Jewish history, we've been using the calendar system. That's where we are today.
That's interesting. So the year 2300.
They knew all this stuff. This stuff
does that coincide with written history?
Oh.
The timeline for written history?
This I don't know.
So it's could way be. Before, this is way early.
200 BC, right?
No, no, not BC. After, of our common era. There's a Roman, I think the Romans were.
Yeah, 200.
So this is way before.
Maybe Julius Caesar?
No, I'm saying the year.
Et tu, Hillel?
After Rome fell in like 15.
No, Rome, Hillel. Yeah, no.
I'm sorry, so Rome fell.
No. Romans destroyed the temple in the year 70. So they were for sure around by then. And they were probably in for a little while. I don't know. We have to have like a parallel history thing. We can look it up to see which empire, you know, was running.
The only reason I'm bringing that up is because...
You want to know how far advanced the Jews were in their science?
Really what I'm thinking about is the fact that it's written down.
Yeah.
In other words, the calculations were...
Written down? My gosh, he created a software for it.
Rabbi, so...
Yeah.
Working off of. It's obviously you've got to be writing it down. So it's got to coincide.
Sure. With important history. Sure. It's the same time the Talmud was written. Jews were writing a lot of stuff. The Mishnah had already been written. The Talmud was being written. And that's when he was one of the Talmudic sages.
It's fascinating to see the formula.
Yeah. I mean, I have a friend who followed it and he wrote up his own version of the calendar. Not version, but his own calendar based on the calculations. Yeah, he researched it. This is going back to like grade school.
Yeah.
He was a genius, that kid. Very smart. Yeah, no, he's a Torsky. He's a genius. Very smart guy. Anyway, bring it back. So that's the way it was done with the court. Today it's done with your calendar. So Rosh Chodesh, we know when it falls out. And some months will be 29 days, some months will be 30 days. We know when the new month is going to be born over Jerusalem. That's how we go. We go by Jerusalem time, like, Greenwich time, we go by Jerusalem standard time. And that's why every, when it's the Shabbat before Rosh Chodesh, there's an announcement made in many synagogues, this one included, saying when the new month, when the new moon will be born. When will the sighting be? Because we don't need to see it. We know when it's going to emerge based on the calculations. So it's going to happen Wednesday morning at 7:30 a.m. and you know, 5/18 of a minute. That's when the new month will be born. Whether anyone sees it or not, we have the astronomical calculations. That's when it will once again appear.
You mean years ago he could tell you at a certain time?
I want to say yes, even that down to that degree of specificity. Yep. Okay. Now, moving on. So what do we do on Rosh Chodesh? So we have no temple, so we're not bringing the 10 animals and all the flour and wine libations. So what are we doing? So we're going to talk about the women in a second. Hold on, the women. We'll talk about the women and the custom that women, Jewish women, have for Rosh Chodesh in a second. But first, turn, please, to text 7. A. Text 7a. You know what? I don't know that we need to read these. I'm going to run through them. I'm going to paraphrase them. So we have the first thing we encounter is Rosh Chodesh is a special day. Don't fast on Rosh Chodesh 7a. Even if sometimes some people have a custom to fast, if they have a bad dream. So you don't want it to turn into something like a bad omen prophecy type thing. So you fast, whatever, but not on Rosh Chodesh. It's a special day. No fasting. Yeah, it's written in Jewish law, yeah.
Really?
Yep. The morning after, the day after, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. To kind of, you know, cleanse that. 7b is, 7b tells us not only not to fast, but to have special meals on Rosh Chodesh, a little extra food. Hey, again, Jews and food, obviously we're doing something special for that. Okay, text 8 tells us, we don't take a haircut on Rosh Chodesh. Again, we're trying to keep it a special day, and we don't want to do things like mundane. Like probably don't today. Maybe it would be like don't get an oil change on that. You know, like keep it a special day. So no haircuts. Add special prayers 9a. You add the Yalla Viyovo, an extra paragraph in the Amida, and then you also add 9b. You add the Hallel prayer, which is the prayer praising God and thanking God for the special day, the day of Rosh Chodesh. It is a mini holiday. We can work on it, but the idea is that it's a mini holiday. It's a special day. And the Torah is read every Rosh Chodesh, 9c. And instead of the three people that are typically called to the Torah on weekdays, Shabbat is 7, but weekdays are 3. On Rosh Chodesh, you call up 4. So you have a little extra special holiness. How you doing?
Enjoy.
Boom. Right. Have a party. Now, if Rosh Chodesh is Shabbat, then of course you do the 7. But if it's a weekday, instead of the 3, you go 4. Now, let's talk about the special connection between women and Rosh Chodesh. So women traditionally have had the custom to celebrate Rosh Chodesh in a unique way. Now, what is the unique way? Every family, every community and every family is different. So there's not one way to do it. But the idea is that women should do something special on Rosh Chodesh. So in many communities, there's a special gathering that takes place, a women's gathering. That's, I think, a more modern twist on it. Traditionally, women would not engage in menial labor. Like if they would traditionally do labor such as like sewing, whatever it was.
Laundry,
ironing, or the domestic. Again, right, this sounds really progressive and great. What I'm saying is in ancient times, let's clarify this, in ancient times when that was kind of the way things went and men were not as domesticated as they should have been, although that could be argued, right, or whatever, right? And men did not do any of this stuff, so the way it fell on the women, or the women traditionally did it, the custom was not to do it on Rosh Chodesh. It's my holiday. Back off. Husband. Children, you sew something, I ain't doing it. So no, I'm kidding. It's not a confrontational thing, but it's the idea is it's a special day. Some women had the custom to wear special garments in Rosh Chodesh or to have a special lavish meal, which we spoke about for everybody, but you know, the women would be involved in that. Whatever. So that is some of what we know was done traditionally. Today, there are Rosh Chodesh groups. We have one here at Chabad in town. It meets approximately Rosh Chodesh. It meets Monday nights, once a month, near and around Rosh Chodesh. So not necessarily on Rosh Chodesh, but it's kind of close, as close as we can get it to Rosh Chodesh itself, and it only meets enough that we can write. It's hard to keep it moving around, so we have it set on Monday nights. Oh, you like it back in one location?
Yeah.
You prefer?
I don't want to have to like RSVP and ask for an address.
Right. I hear that. Okay. Well, next time if we do that, we'll send it to you proactively. Number one. Number two. Okay. Good. Now this helps because we're planning now for the next year. We only have that group, by the way, not the whole year, unfortunately, as of right now. But it's like 7 of the 12 months, or 13 if you have a leap year. But who's counting? It's a great group. Yeah. Yeah. Century. Was that?
Last year. Because it's often.
Did you host it once? Was there one by you? Yeah, it was by you. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
nice.
For me, it's often last minute if I can go or not.
Right.
So, you know, to know it's here, it's easier.
It makes it more consistent.
Because I live nearby, but
right.
I know where it is.
Right. Okay, good. No, this is helpful. This is good. This is good. This is good feedback. Who knows? Okay, good. That's helpful. So where does this connection between Rosh Chodesh and women come from and why? So let's jump into text 10a. We'll do this fairly quickly. Sorry, up to you? Yeah, text 10a. Okay, so this was the golden calf, right? So they say to Aaron, let's do this thing. He says, take off the earrings from your wives, your sons and your daughters, and they bring the earrings that were on their ears. Medrash explains text 10b. This is critical. This is like the key text. Please continue. How cool is that? The men said, oh, let's make this golden calf. It's going to be great. I have this great idea, honey. And she's like, what? Are you kidding me? Not happening. Continue.
The Holy One, blessed be, gave the women their reward in this world that they should observe the new moons more stringently than the men. And he gave them reward in the world to come that they are destined to be renewed like the new moons. As it is said, who satisfies the days of your old age with goodness and the age to come will renew your youth.
How cool is that? How cool is that? Blessing in this world and the world to come, this renewal, this old age also, women live longer than men, maybe it's connected. Bottom line is, the women get the merit, the special blessing of Rosh Chodesh. Why? Because they did not participate in the sin of the golden calf. All the men were in. Jewelry, Aaron's like, jewelry. They're like, yeah, oh yeah, I got all my jewelry, let's make this thing. And the women are like, no, you guys crazy? Yes. Yes.
Like, now it would kind of be taboo for men to wear earrings.
So you're saying what kind of jewelry do they have then? I don't know if it was earrings, maybe just heavy gold chains.
Well, it said like the earrings of your son.
They're like, I'm a rapper. I've been told. They had the Star of David. Yeah. Well, hey, don't forget, who was it that gave Rebecca a nose ring? Remember that one? Eliezer gave Rebecca a nose ring.
Is it a piercing?
No, he didn't actually pierce him. It seems like she already had, I don't know. It was one of the things that he gave her jewelry upon the, you know, before the match with Isaac, and one of the pieces there was a nose ring. So apparently it was something that was done. There's no prohibition in Torah against that. I mean, why is the ear different than the nose? It's more of a cultural thing. I'm not suggesting that everyone go out and pierce their nose. I'm just saying that, like, I don't know of any. I don't know of any prohibition specifically against that. And again, it does say that she had a nose ring. Whatever. It is. You know, we'll leave this for another class. I'm sure there's a. You know, we can talk about this. Again, that's a matter of whatever. Again, this will leave for another class. Let's get back to the main issue. So the question is,
don't sugarcoat it.
So yeah, but tell us how you really feel. So let's just break this down, and then we're going to conclude. So the women don't participate in the sin of the golden calf. So that's great. Because of that, they get Rosh Chodesh. What's the connection? I want to mention a few things. The first thing is found in text 11. We're not going to read it inside. We're done with the text. I'm just going to share with you a few insights outside, and then we're going to close the books. Number one, originally, so the three festivals, the three biblical pilgrimage festivals, correspond to the three patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, the 12 months of the year, the Rosh Chodesh for the 12 months, were supposed to correspond to the 12 tribes. But guess what? All 12 tribes were busy dancing around that golden calf. So God's like, you don't get a holiday. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob didn't do this, so their holidays still stand. But the tribes should get the 12 months? Not happening. So who are we going to give it to? It'll be a special day for the women because they did not participate in this. So we're pulling it away from the tribes and we're giving it specifically to, we're not breaking it down by 12 tribes, we'll give it now to the Jewish women who did not participate in the sin. That's the basic reason. But there's a deeper reason, and that is that the new month represents renewal and the idea of light born of darkness. In a time when the Jews were sinning, there was one light that shone forth. And who was that coming from? The women, right? And at the time when the men were confused, where's Moses? What should we do? Where's God? Let's create our own God. Let's create an idol. Let's dance around it and do all these things. In all of that confusion and darkness, there was a light that shone, that emanated, that radiated from one segment of the community that said clearly, there is a God. What are you doing? This is Meshuggah. This is crazy, right? You got to stay focused on the truth. Where did that light come from again? That came from the women. Therefore, it is the Jewish women that have a special connection with Rosh Chodesh, which is literally the light of the moon emerging after the absence, the darkness. And the message for us is, no matter what whether you're a man or a woman, again, understand the special connection between women and Rosh Chodesh. At the same time, the universal message is, no matter where we've been, no matter what we've done, no matter how difficult things are, there's always a chance for a renewal and a new light to be born. Thank you for joining me tonight for Torah Studies.